The Milwaukee Police and Fire Commission has planned and rescheduled several votes on policy for the city police department and how it works with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents, or ICE. The group met last week at Milwaukee City Hall. There were protests by immigration activists. Isaiah Holmes was there. He's a reporter with the Wisconsin Examiner. He joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. Isaiah, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, who was protesting there and why?
Well, it was a lot of community members. Obviously, the organization Voices de la Frontera kind of hosted and spearheaded the entire event, as they had for the last couple of weeks up until that point. But it was dozens of community members of all ages and backgrounds, really. Some immigrant born, many people just residents of Milwaukee.
And this issue of how local law enforcement agencies cooperate or don't with ICE has been going on a long time. Why has this issue been coming to a head in the police, Fire and Police Commission there and from protesters lately?
Part of it is Voices de la Frontera has been pushing the Fire and Police Commission to strengthen their standard operating procedure in regards to immigration and customs enforcement. That's called SPO 130. They've been trying to do that since June, and the vote keeps getting delayed and delayed for various reasons. And in that time, a family has had their father and husband arrested by ICE in front of their home. Jose Alejandro de la Cruz Espinoza, who goes by Alex, or a nickname is Alex, and his wife, Christine, and his daughters have been going to the City Hall demonstrations and speaking and pleading for his return.
What do we know about Milwaukee police policy when it comes to how and when they cooperate with ICE agents?
The current police chief, Alfonso Morales, and actually Ed Flynn, too, the former police chief, both said that they don't necessarily want to do things like stop people and ask for their immigration status or do things which could negatively impact community relations, and obviously local police depend on the community trusting them to call them and give them tips and report crimes and things like that. And this can be a struggle enough. And then when you add the added pressure from the federal government of enforcing the duties of federal agents, then it adds a burden on the police department.
And as we wrap up, Isaiah, is there a new plan for when the Fire and Police Commission would vote on this policy?
Right now, it's up in the air. The Voices de la Frontera is pushing for it to happen within the next 2 weeks or in 2 weeks. But I've also heard that it could be as late as Thanksgiving weekend. And they're really trying, and by they, I mean Voices de la Frontera and members of the community, are really trying to have that not happen so that as many people can be involved as possible.
Isaiah, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
That's Isaiah Holmes, reporter with the Wisconsin Examiner. Now we want to broaden this topic out to the national scene of how ICE is working in other communities and jurisdictions around the country. Angela S. Garcia is a sociologist and assistant professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. She studies international law and society and urban sociology. She's the author of the book Legal Passing, Navigating Undocumented Life and Local Immigration Law. Angela, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard a little bit about what's going on in Milwaukee there when it comes to relationships between ICE and local law enforcement. Is this a question that communities around the country are wrestling with right now?
Absolutely. Communities across the United States have long wrestled with questions of immigration enforcement. So this isn't necessarily new, but it's rising to a head now. Given a lot of the movement around immigration in the Trump administration. And basically, cities alongside states are falling into kind of two large buckets. There's cities and states that try to do immigration enforcement, encourage it, embrace it, take it on. And then there's those that don't want anything to do with it, find that it interferes with their charge to be involved with community safety.
Are there communities in a sort of middle ground at all where they don't try to do primary enforcement, they don't check immigration status for everybody they interact with, but for, say, people convicted of felonies or charged with felonies, they might alert ICE on an immigration status? Is there a middle ground there anywhere?
Well, there's certainly communities that don't have a policy written on the books at all, but I would say oftentimes that not having a policy is actually taking a stance in some ways. There are federal level enforcement policies that are pushed on to states and localities, and where the rubber meets the road is how they respond to that charge. So, for example, the Secure Communities Program, which Trump reinstated, it had been ended by the Obama administration in 2014 and then taken back up in 2017 after the inauguration. That program matches fingerprints that are taken of anyone who's booked and sent to the FBI. It matches those fingerprints that the FBI receives to DHS databases that does immigration checks. What happens is if you're flagged as someone who's potentially undocumented, that information goes back to the agency that booked you, and DHS issues a detainer. Where states and localities have some space to decide is what to do with that detainer, because that detainer is a request. And there have been federal court decisions saying that holding someone beyond their scheduled release date is actually unconstitutional. And so many jurisdictions do not support those requests. And it's my understanding that in Milwaukee, that's the case.
And you've written about this on a policy level. We have a federal immigration policy, which is a pretty powerful thing. But there are also state and local immigration policies, and they often come into conflict with each other. It can be a little confusing.
It can be very confusing. In fact, a colleague refers to our kind of current state of affairs and immigration in the United States as a multi-layered, multi-jurisdictional patchwork. Literally, your threat of being deported changes quite a lot if you cross county lines or city lines or state lines. And that can mean, you know, a distance of several miles, can mean quite a different context that you face if you are an undocumented person. And that's some of the work that I do in my book, is talk about how that plays out in people's everyday lives.
Right. And you write that while there's an impression that under the risk of a raid or the worry about running into police, people are working in the shadows, you say there are a lot of ways that people, undocumented immigrants in the U.S., deal with that and live their daily lives. I know you wrote a whole book about this. We can't go into all of it, but give us some examples of that.
Well, sure. I mean, keeping it sort of close to the topic of police, in localities that have deep relationships with ICE that encourage police to do the work of immigration enforcement, immigrants are generally unwilling to interact with the police. And that's even around questions of violent crime, either experience it themselves or being witnesses to it. And that's really because any kind of interaction with the police in these kinds of communities means that there is a heightened threat of deportation. When we talk about non-crime moments in people's lives, you know, in the restrictive places that I study, places that have deep relationships with ICE and the police, people inevitably have to carry on with their daily lives. People have to get to work, have to get to the laundromat and the grocery store. And so the ways that they do that, that I document in my book, imply attempting to pass as someone who has a legal status. And that extends from the way that they try to walk through public space to the ways that they dress, to a minimization of using any language other than English in public, a real kind of forced or coercive changing of oneself in public.
And how about in communities where there isn't strong cooperation with ICE, the cities, whether they call themselves sanctuary cities or kind of overlap in policies, what is life like there?
Well, there's much more of an ease in everyday life, a sense of stability, a sense of local membership. and buy-in in the community. And when we think about interactions with police, I want to say that even in jurisdictions that have strong sanctuary ordinances on the books, there's no magic wand or silver bullet that can entirely resolve the fear, especially between low-income communities of color, generally, and then add people who are undocumented on top of that, that can resolve some of the street level tensions that unfold in these communities on street corners between them and the police. But that said, when I speak with people that live in sanctuary jurisdictions who lack authorization status, they say they're generally willing to interact with the police and give examples where they have interacted with the police. Tension, or I should say fear of contacting the police in those kinds of places, often comes from potential retaliation for reporting gang-related activity rather than fear of being deported.
We're talking to University of Chicago sociologist Angela Garcia about interactions between ICE and local governments and law enforcement. We'll go to a caller now. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. So I think that undocumented immigrants are vital parts of our community and our economy. Many people are fleeing economic devastation and violence. Much of it was caused by United States intervention in Latin America. I think that it's incumbent. I hope in La Crosse we would resist the actions of ICE. ICE is acting in ways that violate the most basic human rights, separating families, treating children like criminals. I think that it's appalling what's happening, and I hope that we do not cooperate with ICE. And in fact, I would call upon fellow citizens to do what we can to protect our undocumented sisters and brothers in our community.
Ben, thanks for the call. Angela, what are you seeing around the country when it comes to doing what Ben was just saying there, in a sense, resist ICE activities in local communities?
Well, there are certainly activists on the ground who are doing a lot of the work that the caller referenced. So in July, when the Trump administration threatened large-scale raids across big cities with sanctuary policy, cities like Chicago and L.A., San Francisco and Oakland, mayors came out in force saying that they would not involve their police in any kind of supporting role. In the city of Chicago, aldermen organized roving patrols of neighborhoods so that if any ICE officers or ICE vehicles were spotted, they could send out alerts to the entire community. And these were community-driven and local elected-driven efforts. In fact, the mayor of Oakland several months back got word that ICE was coming to do a raid in Oakland, and she spoke out about it publicly on social media, issuing a warning to the immigrant community that this was planned to happen in Oakland the following day. Got a lot of pushback from the federal immigration enforcement officials for doing that, but there's certainly ways that both local electeds and community members on the ground who are concerned can speak up and push back.
We asked our listeners about this on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of people shared just a common theme that local law enforcement should cooperate with federal immigration agencies. They see it as the default position. Law enforcement is law enforcement. You should cooperate across jurisdictions. And that's a pretty common argument out there, Angela.
It's a common argument, I think, among some sections of the public, but I'll say that it's not a commonly held sentiment amongst police chiefs and sheriffs themselves. So a recent book published by the University of Chicago Press called Policing Immigrants interviewed more than 750 police chiefs and sheriffs all across the country. And in red states and blue states alike, a majority of these law enforcement officials expressed serious concerns about involving their officers in immigration enforcement and said that immigration enforcement should remain a federal responsibility, in part because effective policing requires trust between residents and police. And that's what my book also confirms. You know, we know that if unauthorized immigrants, we have an estimate of about 10 million people and their families. We know there's about 9 million people who live in mixed status or mixed legal status families. If they fear any interaction with the police can lead to their arrest and their deportation, they'll be less likely to report crimes, make statements, testify in court. And then people that commit crimes will be more likely to get away with and endanger others. I think the other point to make here is that research consistently shows that immigrants are far less likely than those born in the United States to commit crimes.
Talking to Angela Garcia from the University of Chicago, talking about local law enforcement and ICE, immigration, customs enforcement, where they work together, where they don't. Back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Appleton. Lisa, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Lisa?
Well, I just want to share a little bit of my experience. I've been living in Appleton for almost 16 years, and I still live in the shadows because, unfortunately, immigration is taking so long. It's not something that you can do so easy. Just sharing my story, I have 5 kids, and I have one in Milwaukee University, and he started this year. And now it's really hard for me to think to go visit him because you are afraid to go and get caught by the police in the area.
Lisa, thank you for sharing your story. Angela, does that sound like a lot of the stories you heard in researching your book?
Yeah. Lisa, I'd also say thank you for calling to share. I'm really glad that you're listening today and contributing. I think that actually hearing from voices like yours are way more important than hearing from people like me. I did hear very similar stories to what Lisa has just shared, and I continue to hear these stories in research that I'm doing now in Chicago. In particular, you know, the thing that the caller just said about having a child who's just started university but being unable to visit her child who's in university. I'm working with a family right now who's got a child who was accepted with a scholarship to a university on the East Coast and struggled a lot in even trying to get him there for orientation and to get moved into the dorm because they lacked they lack immigration status. And she's right. It's not an easy thing to fix. In fact, for many people, there's literally no line to get into to fix an immigration status.
Lisa, thanks for that call. Angela, what would you like to see change, I don't know, at the federal level, at the local level, to, help people like Lisa not feel like they were in the shadows like that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that localities can do. They can, even from symbolic things that serve to transmit a stance or an agenda or an orientation on the issue to the immigrant community, I think those kind of welcoming ordinances are important, and they can lead to more substantive changes that involve resource allocation or institutional change to support immigrant communities on the ground. All of this is possible, and there's good examples of cities that are moving in that direction. But the caveat here is that these changes are important, but they're insufficient because only Congress can do a comprehensive immigration reform that will provide an attainable legalization path forward to the many people in the United States who lack authorization status. And so while states and localities can do quite a lot to manage the conditions under which undocumented community members live, they're limited in what they can do to change anyone's immigration status.
Do you have high hopes that Congress could pass, anything related to immigration?
No, I don't.
We'll leave it there. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Angela Garcia. She's a sociologist and professor at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. We talked with her today about ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and how it interacts with local governments, local law enforcement in different communities around the country.